This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Ebola Monday. This seems to be becoming a regular thing now on the BBS radio network, The People Speak. Please have your calls ready on 1-888-429-5471. That's toll-free for the United States and Canada. And for those of you wishing to call from outside the US and Canada, that'll be 530-763-1594. So here we are on The People Speak again on a Monday. This week we have Dr. Jane Orient, who is the with the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, which she is the executive director of. Welcome to The People Speak, Dr. Orient. We've had an enormous amount of interest in this topic, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, let's get down to it. Obviously, a lot of people are very concerned. I've just noticed, and I don't know if you've had time to check this, the CDC has yet another directive out. We've had some good news today from Nigeria and from Senegal saying that they're rid of the virus, but apparently it's spreading in rapid rates in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. And that's what their health officials are reporting at the moment. There was some reports that some more equipment had shown up in these countries, particularly, I think, Sierra Leone today. Is there a way of stopping this, Doctor?
That's an excellent question. I guess Nigeria stopped it by stopping people who might have it from entering the country. And They have declared themselves free of Ebola because there has not been a new case for 42 days. Now notice that's twice as long as the CDC says is the period of quarantine. And WHO says there are people who acquire the disease as long as 42 days after they are exposed. I have been saying that, well, you ought to wait 25 days because that's two standard deviations from the mean of the incubation period. So while we've released our contacts of Mr. Duncan from quarantine at 21 days, let us hope that that we waited long enough.
Well, let's hope so. What are your thoughts on the not only the CDC's handling of this? A number of us have the thought, and this is my opinion and my opinion only, do you think the CDC is basically kowtowing to the administration and their wishes, or do you think they are acting autonomously?
It seems to me that they are kowtowing to the administration because they're really seeking to come up with some sort of rationale for the idea that we don't need to block entry from people who might have been exposed. It just seems what they're saying just seems absurd to me, that we might make the situation worse in West Africa if we don't let some of the people from there come here.
Yeah, I was rather perplexed about that. It didn't make a lot of sense to me, and especially as countries like, you know, my homeland, the UK, they shut off flights. The French have done the same. And it just seems a bit weird that we would let this, you know, effectively enter. If you imagine if it got on the London Underground, the Paris Metro, the New York subway, that the spread of this, it could really be mind-boggling, could it not, Doctor? I mean, also the big question that lots of people have argued about and was a question of contention last week with Dr. C.J. Peters is, you know, is this airborne or, you know, is it constrained as airborne in the fact that if somebody projectile vomits or has horrible diarrhea or something like that and sort of vapor comes up, you know, people are very concerned about this, and I think there's a lot of panic within people traveling. We saw last week airline tickets decrease in purchasing from, you know, the major hubs, be it Kayak and, you know, other wholesalers and liquidators, as well as the major airlines, in the fact that people were like not confident that they wanted to get on an aeroplane when they may possibly be sitting next to somebody that may have a disease that they're not sure about.
People are really very frightened, and I think they've lost confidence in the CDC's reassurances about this point. I wish they would be clear in their language. I mean, to say something is airborne to the layperson means, yeah, if somebody throws up on you and you catch the disease, it was airborne. But what the scientists really mean for this, and I've not heard anyone in the media explain it, is that in droplets, like from a sneeze or cough, they evaporate very quickly down to droplet nuclei, which are tiny enough to get through your mask or through the ventilation system. And they are saying that the Ebola virus does not survive this drying process, unlike influenza, for example. Yet, there is evidence published in the scientific literature in 2010 showing that indeed the Ebola virus does survive for a time on these droplet nuclei, not as long as with some of the other viruses, but 1% of it still left after 90 minutes. And since it only takes fewer than 10 viruses to give you a lethal disease, this is something that's really concerning. And it's why the World Health Organization has classified this as a level 4 pathogen. It requires biosafety level BSL-4 precautions to work with it safely.
Yeah, I think I've got a question actually here from Don in Northern California, and he asks me this. He says, why were the ill Americans with Ebola brought to the United States for treatment? How is the CDC effectively protecting the American public by bringing potentially contagious people to the United States? Is that not a danger? Because I think people were concerned about that. Now, obviously, the CDC did have success with the doctor and the female medical worker that they brought there to Emory. Obviously, they do have a lot of experience. And obviously, that sophisticated air ambulance that they transported them in was obviously a very high-tech piece of equipment. And you were talking about extremely well-trained personnel. And as we saw last week in Dallas, Texas, I'm sure that's generally a very good hospital, and yet basically they didn't have a very good result, and it didn't look very professional. Would you like to comment on that, Doctor?
We have about 11 hospital beds in this country that are capable of using BSL for precautions on sick patients. And so where are we going to put these people if we bring them here? Also, we need to remember that the military's air evacuation airplane that enabled them to use BSL-4 precautions was dismantled in 2010. We used to have such a flight capability, and we got rid of it. It would bring someone from the field who had a extremely contagious disease directly to a hospital that could handle it without exposing people along the way and without putting at risk the people in the hospital or on the transport. But, you know, we don't have that anymore, and we really need to demand that Congress find out why this program was stopped and what we're going to use in its place if we're going to be bringing people here.
So was that program effectively defunded then, the doctor?
It was just dismantled, defunded, it no longer exists.
Oh, okay. Now, I believe the CDC used a contractor out of Dobbins Air Force Base, which is effectively in Marietta, Georgia. Would that service be available or not?
That I don't know. But certainly if there is a service that is comparable to the military transport. It's not widely available, and we have no idea what its capacity is, but I'll wager it's not very great.
Yeah, I think that plane actually, it looked like a smaller Gulfstream, and it looked like it could really only handle one passenger. So it wasn't a particularly large aircraft, and it sounds like the one that you had before could possibly have taken more patients.
That I'm not sure about.
Okay, well, good. What do you think about Dr. Thomas Frieden? Do you think, the man obviously isn't particularly a politician. What struck me was when he went over to Africa, and I saw video of him there. He was effectively wearing a full hazmat suit, so to speak, with breathing apparatus. Yet it seems like when they had the patient in Texas, the nurses had very little equipment and had nothing respiratory as protection for themselves. Doctor, did we lose you there? I heard a Skype noise. I don't know if Don lost you.
I can hear you.
Okay, good. Good. Did you hear my question?
I did. That
Okay.
really looks hypocritical, doesn't it? That the equipment that the nurses have is good enough for them, but not good enough for me. And if they catch the disease, they must have broken protocol somehow. But yet, before he got out of his suit, he was thoroughly doused with chlorine disinfectant. And that was not being done in Dallas. You have to just try not to touch the outside of your protective gear, and then touch your face, which I guess is what the Spanish nurse did.
Yeah, it's a very sad case, and let's hope those two nurses actually recover completely from this. And obviously, it's going to be probably a couple more weeks yet till we find out exactly what's happened with them. What would you advise if you were given the position that Dr. Frieden is in there at the CDC? Would your position be that to shut down air travel from West African countries? Do you think that is prudent at this juncture?
Well, I think that we need to shut down entry to this country of for anyone who has been in those three countries where the epidemic is raging, unless they have been in an isolation for at least 21 days. We don't have any direct flights from West Africa to the US. They all go through Brussels or London or someplace else in Europe, but people who are traveling from those countries, I think could cause a huge public health risk, even if we do manage to get to contain it before a couple of nurses get infected. I think that's what the CDC should do. I think that if it were an independent agency, it would insist upon it. After all, at least 19 countries in Africa are doing that, and Saudi Arabia, and as you pointed out, the UK and France. And then Belize refused to allow a cruise ship to dock, because there was a person on there who was still within the isolation period.
I believe Mexico joined in with that as well, Doctor. I believe that
Yes,
Mexico
yes.
refused entry as well. Yeah, that's very perplexing when you think that these other countries are doing this, and then for some reason, I don't know whether the administration thinks they know more, whether they've been assured by the CDC, no, we can handle this. I mean, personally, and a lot of people have spoken about this, I think that obviously, the supply chain issues back to these countries is, of course, an issue. And of course, these people need help, medical supplies, IVs, everything else, beds and things. But could the US military not be better positioned to drop that off, and then we don't have passengers coming back in the other direction?
Well, there's no reason why you have to shut off flights to the area. There's no reason why we could not be providing all the humanitarian aid that we can muster. That doesn't mean that we have to let people in who may be infected and then just take the risk. I don't know how much money it costs just to do the contact tracing in Dallas.
No, it's probably a lot of money. Anyway, we have a caller. Don, can we put line one to Dr. Orient?
Hello, how are you?
Thanks for calling. Can you give us your name and your location and your question for Dr. Orient, please?
Yes, it's John in Ontario, Canada. Can you hear me?
We can, John, loud and clear. I think Dr. Orient can hear you. Your question for the doctor.
Yes, hello, Dr. Orient. Thank you very much for being with us tonight. My question stems from the unprecedented scale of the outbreak in Africa, the number of frontline healthcare workers being infected, the nurses in Dallas being infected. It seems to me as though there's a lot of questions that could be asked here. And my skepticism about what we know is bolstered by Dr. Michael Ostrom of the Center for Infectious Diseases at the University of Minnesota. He asserts that there's an awful lot we don't know. He cites a Dr. Gary Kobinger at the Canada's National Lab in Winnipeg. And he says he was given permission in a recent talk just, I guess, today on C-SPAN, that Dr. Kobinger at the Canadian National Lab infected two macaque monkeys with the Guinea strain of Ebola, and his remark was the lung pathology was remarkable. So both of those doctors see this potential virus as extremely disturbing. And then in a recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine, October 9th, 2014, entitled Emergence of Zaire Ebola Virus versus Disease in Guinea, co-authored by 30 doctors, they say there, this is a quote, direct quote from the article, the high degree of similarity among the 15 partial L gene sequences, along with the three full-length sequences and the epidemiological links between the cases, suggest a single introduction of the virus into the human population. Now, the interpretation of that, I don't really fully understand. But the suggestion is that we're dealing with a new strain of Ebola, and we don't actually know how it was introduced into the human population. Could you comment on that and clarify this statement of this suggests a single introduction of the virus into the human population? I don't understand that statement.
Well, I'm not sure what should be so surprising about it. I think that that might be all that it takes, that you get one person infected and then from then on it's transmitted human to human. You don't necessarily have to have 100 fruit bats or whatever vector species all introducing it and to different people. But I think that this is an RNA virus. It mutates very rapidly, and so we could see it infecting the lungs more heavily than before. Unlike the influenza, Ebola has not been characterized by just huge amounts of respiratory secretions teeming with virus. This could change, but even if it doesn't, if people, we know the virus is in the fluid in the mouth, it's in vomit and so on, and so if that is aerosolized and it survives long enough on a droplet to be inhaled through your mask, then it can cause an infection.
So is it possible this is a totally new strain of Ebola?
Well, certainly there have been new strains before, and as I say, it's an RNA virus, so that's one typical thing about them. That's why we have a new influenza vaccine every year, and why we're constantly worried about, you know, avian flu or swine flu or some other type of influenza emerging from one of the other species that it infects. Ebola and influenza and a whole lot of other viruses are zoonotic diseases. They exist in animals. They may not make the animal very sick, but at some point, if it could be transmitted to a human being, you could have a disastrous epidemic.
Well, the suggestion in this article apparently is that we really don't know how this strain was introduced to a human population. Would you agree with that?
I have two people talking at once, so I didn't hear what you say.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just finish up your question, John, from Canada, briefly with the doctor, because we have other people waiting. But if you can make this the last part of your follow-up question, John, to Dr. Orient.
No problem. It suggests in the article that we don't know how this was actually introduced to the human population. Is that true?
I think there are a whole lot of things that we don't know about it. I have not read any explanation for how the epidemic started in West Africa when it had not been seen in that part of the continent before.
Right. Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you, John. Right. Now over to line two. We have Jess calling from Arkansas. Over to you. Your question for Dr. Orient, please, Jess.
Hello, doctor. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. The question that I have, and the thing that's been foremost on my mind in this whole situation, you know, with all of this confusion that's in the media, is the vaccine, this experimental vaccine that they're in such a rush to deliver. Maybe you can speak a little bit about what you know about it and where this is really coming from, because there's been a lot of confusion about it also. Yeah. There's been a lot of confusion as to what's in the vaccine and is there going to be any oversight. And we know that one of the corporations just got sued billions of dollars for lying in their pharmaceutical business anyway. So how can these people be trusted? And is it possible, in your professional opinion, that the vaccine itself could end up presenting more danger than the virus?
I don't know anything about. I don't know anything about the vaccine. I do know that there are said to be one or more vaccines that are about to enter phase one testing. I am sure that people have been working on a vaccine for quite a long time, not just because of the previous small outbreaks in Africa, but because this virus has been researched on a vast scale as a biological warfare agent. And naturally, you wouldn't want to have a biological warfare agent without being able to protect your own population. Or if you're worried about being attacked with such a virus, then there's a lot of good reasons for working on it for defense.
Yeah, interestingly,
the second part of it.
Yeah, go ahead, John. Jess, you finish your question. Sorry about that.
Okay, so here's a second question that I have in regards to the RNA. You know, how apparently everything I've read leads me to believe that this type of warfare was developed in the 1980s as a result of whatever interplay was going on between the then Soviet Union and the United States now, or at the time. Everything we know about the recombinant part of the virus splicing, right, where they're able to. And I'm not going to try and sound professional because I really don't know that much about it, but I'm wondering if you can explain a little bit about recombinant biological warfare as it regards the virus, what kind of impact that could have in exasperating the entire situation, and how people could protect themselves from that, if they could protect themselves from it.
Well,
and that's my last question.
Look, I've never worked in. I've never worked at any of our biological warfare establishments. I only know that they exist, and we know that recombinant technology exists, and that's how we are able to persuade bacteria to make human insulin for us. That's how we make genetically modified crops. That biotechnology has a lot of horrendous implications. I wrote a newsletter about 10 years ago that talked about the concept of Ebola pox, where they could combine the Ebola virus with smallpox, and smallpox being so much more readily transmitted through the air. I don't know whether this is speculation. I don't know how much work was done on it. I just know that there are these terrors out there that technology may make possible. And how do we protect ourselves from it? Well, I'm sure a lot of people are asking themselves that question.
Yes, they definitely are, Doctor. And we had an interesting comment actually last week when one of our callers called into CJ Peters, and they basically were asking if this was the Marburg virus and not Ebola. He said it wasn't, but he had some interesting things to say about Marburg, and you know, obviously the monkeys were infected and also the handlers died over there. And then he did go on to comment about his work up in Maryland, where he was with the Army's play toy up there, where he'd done quite a lot of developmental work, I believe. And obviously that's where they're probably, experimenting with things like what you just mentioned. And interestingly enough, he was also talking about the infected monkeys up in Reston, Virginia, that he was involved in actually shutting down that facility, which probably wasn't very easy to do. Interestingly, though, with Dr. Peters, he wasn't for quarantining the area and stopping the flights. Now, I don't know that's whether he's got some sort of vested interest in towing the line with the CDC and the administration, or whether he actually genuinely believes that. I was to and fro on his thoughts with that. Obviously, you've been a lot more candid about your thoughts on it. But what I did think was interesting is when he was actually in charge of having to stop an outbreak of Ebola, be it in Africa or in the United States up here with the monkeys, obviously then he did quarantine everything at that point. And it seemed interesting that his actions were different from his words. Could you comment on that?
Well, like you say, it's a very interesting observation. And I'm getting an echo and feedback.
I think what we should do at the moment is, why don't we take a break at the moment on the People Speak, Don? See if we can get the engineering handled. Please keep your calls coming in. Call us at the BBS Radio Network on 1-888-429-5471. We will take a quick break now. Keep the calls coming in for Dr. Jane Orient. I think it's fascinating. We're talking Ebola again. It's the Monday night Ebola show. So please keep calling in. Over to you, Don, and let's take the quick break.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please. Give to the World Food Program.
The This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Welcome back to The People Speak. Rob Kitzel here tonight. I'm privileged to be here on the BBS Radio Network. I'm here with Dr. Jane Orient. And we have another caller calling in, and I believe they're from North Carolina. Can you put Anna through to Dr. Orient, please, Don? Thank you.
Welcome to the program, Anna.
Thank you. Hello, can you hear me, Doctor?
Yes.
Okay, I'll try to pause for a minute. It's something going on. Anyway, I just wanted just to ask a simple question. We were talking about vaccinations and things, you know, before you came on, and I was wondering, would you take the vaccination shot, the vaccine? Would you be willing to take it?
I think vaccines have dangers, and I don't tend to be an early adopter, as they say, of things like that. Whether the risk is greater than the benefit or the other way around kind of depends on the situation, of whether there's an outbreak in your area, of how much the vaccine has been tested. So I can't really give just a pat answer to your question.
Yeah, so you're just kind of confused, like a lot of us, that we really don't know exactly about it, so until we do, you know, why take it?
I think the best way to protect against this is to stay away from the virus. That means quarantine and contact tracing, and that really is the first line of defense.
Yeah, well, what's so funny is I work at Emory Hospital, and so when the patients came and was there, a lot of people from North Georgia were exposed. So, you know, that's just a little irritating to me, just to have this such thing come into our country. There's just a lot of questions and a lot of confusion. But I do appreciate your answers, ma'am, and I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Anna. It's an interesting perspective. And I think, Doctor, a lot of people are very troubled by this. It's almost like people feel like they've unnecessarily brought something, you know, almost into our house here. It's almost like a unwanted guest, isn't it? And I think people are terrified when you hear some of the symptoms of Ebola and everything. And I know this is a potentially different strain from the other one. And Dr. Peters, actually, when he was asked the question last week about the mortality rates, he was slightly puzzled about, you know, the difference in the mortality rates. What do you read into the mortality rates on this strain of Ebola? Do you think it's just because it's a different strain? Or what's your perspective on that?
I just read that in West Africa, the mortality rate is now 70%. We can have a different strain at any time as it mutates very rapidly. I think one thing to keep in mind is there are a lot of unknowns about this virus. And so it really seems to me to be reckless to speak with great degree of certainty, like you can't get it this way, you can't get it that way, it's not going to come here, you're not at any risk, when there's so many answers that we don't know. It's very hard to work with the virus. It endangers everybody who works with it. One mistake and you could die.
Yes, and actually, I saw something today actually quite interesting where I was watching the people in Nigeria. And it is really a heartwarming story where they had the doctor's son on. And the patient there, I don't know whether it was because of the Ebola or whatever, but he became very agitated. They realized what he had, and they told him he wasn't leaving the hospital. He seemed to be quite a large man. And as the story went, and this story is from the BBC, so I do have a little bit of grain of salt from them, but that's for another reason. But they stated that this man effectively tried to leave the hospital. Anyway, the doctor, who was a lady doctor there, said there's no way he's leaving. Her and three other workers stopped him physically from leaving. And unfortunately, all four of them were infected and lost their lives. But they did stop him from leaving the hospital. And they said they were not prepared to have him leave the hospital and be wandering around Lagos, which obviously has a large population there in Nigeria. And the doctor and her staff were determined that he did not leave the hospital and effectively ended up sacrificing their lives to do so. Very brave people indeed. And that leads me to another question. How do you think, with the mortality rate of Doctors Without Borders and other medical workers being not at a good stage there, maybe one in four, one in five chance of the medical workers maybe dying on the job, how are you going to get enough people in to West Africa to treat, 10,000 people?
I don't know how you can possibly do that.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. Anyway,
what are you going to do? Force them?
I know.
Either go in there and take every bullet.
Yeah, I don't think it's something anybody wants to volunteer for, is it? I mean, it's very, very difficult. And, this is what people, I don't think, are realizing. And I don't think people realize how tiny this virus is. And somebody was explaining it to me a few days ago, where it was like a thousand times smaller than a water droplet or something. I mean, it's almost like microscopic, is it not, Doctor? I mean, it's just...
No, you can't see it. You cannot see it under the microscope. It is submicroscopic. You have to have an electron microscope to see it.
Wow. Yeah, that gets it to be extremely frightening then, doesn't it? Anyway, we have another caller on the line now. Don has Isabel calling from Washington State. Isabel is actually a friend of mine. She's an RN. So if we can put her through to Dr. Orient.
Last week's show, Dr. Peters was on, and he said that the CDC was doing an adequate job. On Wednesday, after the show, the National Nurses United Organization, they held a webcast basically criticizing the CDC for being inadequate, not training nurses. My question to you is about the screeners at the airport. Are you aware of any type of training or robing that they need to do? And, in the hospitals, once the person is diagnosed, we now know the protocols that need to be used with Ebola patients. But is the CDC adequately informing these agents? And isn't it negligent of Homeland Security to have them out there with not even gloves or masks on while they're screening people coming off of flights?
I don't know what's going on with the screeners, and I don't know how they have been trained. I certainly know that there are imperfections in the thermometers, and that people can take acetaminophen or ibuprofen and mask their fever. I've been told by nurses that they've been promised protocols, but they haven't seen them yet. There may be a protocol, but they haven't tried on the equipment or haven't practiced putting it on and taking it off or working while they have it. I don't know that they've got any positive pressure respirators with filtered air. Many of the nurses have been complaining bitterly that they're being expected to put their lives on the line without adequate equipment and without adequate training in protective measures.
Right. Can you also speak about what needs to be done when medical professionals are de-offing their PPE gear? What needs to be done to kill the virus before they take off?
Well, what they do, what Doctors Without Borders do in Africa is they thoroughly drench them with strong chlorine disinfectant solution. And then they take off the gear. The CDC has posters that you can look at which shows you how you're supposed to take it off without touching the outside of it. So good luck if you manage to slip up.
Yeah, I doubt anyone's going to be bleaching anyone in the hospitals, but is ultraviolet light also a way to kill off the virus?
Yes. Yes, it is sensitive to ultraviolet light. I don't know how long it takes to kill it. I know there have been experiments with using the filoviruses, of which Ebola is one, out in the sun at different places at different times of the year. And it may take more than an hour to kill 90% of the virus. It's more sensitive to UVC, which is a shorter wavelength ultraviolet. And they've got some robots now, I understand, called UV zapping robots that are being used to clean the rooms. I don't know whether they've tried that with people. You, of course, have to protect your eyes very carefully, but that would be something to look into.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you. Good questions there, Isabel. Yes, would hospitals have a problem using chlorine to almost like a wash tank that was like a shower unit where they would shower people down with chlorine, which obviously chlorine has its own dangers, doesn't it, in its own right?
Chlorine bleach, I think you know chlorine bleach, we use a lot of it, and I don't think that's particularly dangerous, but I don't think the hospitals have like an ante room before the patient's room where you can take a decontaminating shower like they would at a BSL-4 facility. In Africa, of course, they don't have showers. They've got tanks with spray guns on them, and they spray people. You can see pictures of it on the internet.
Yeah, that's it is troubling when you think about the risk that maybe they've put these nurses as, and as you said, it is a bit hypocritical of Dr. Frieden to have been in his full suit, and they've got no respiratory gear or anything else. Anyway, we have another caller on now. It's Mike calling you from California. Mike from California, you're on with Dr. Orient.
Hello, Dr. Orient. Something that's been weighing on my mind is, especially in this age where the United States is concerned about terrorism, what, in your opinion, is the possibility of Ebola being weaponized, used as an agent to terrorize, to kill in the United States by outside forces? Could it be mailed into the country? Could an infected person be easily smuggled in? I guess someone already has proved that, Mr. Duncan, but even though he wasn't a terrorist, but could an army of people infected, or in some way, could the virus be spread throughout, you know, our poorer communities, among the homeless? I mean, I shudder to think what would happen in that case.
I know that ISIS has reportedly talked about this, and if they don't mind blowing themselves up, perhaps they wouldn't mind getting infected with the virus. There's a long enough incubation period that they could come into the country while asymptomatic and do this. And our southern border, of course, might as well just not exist. People from Liberia and from West Africa are apprehended there. They could just walk in at any time. And we do know that Ebola has been researched as a biological weapon. The Soviets succeeded in weaponizing Marburg, which is a relative of Ebola, and they had it on warheads that would go on intercontinental ballistic missiles. And the warhead would release all these little bomblets that would explode and spray this virus all over the place. Apparently, they didn't manage to get the Ebola to survive long enough in an aerosol, but they tried.
Well, I couldn't think of a very cheap way of this literally spreading up epidemic in a country you hate so much than by just simply using something readily at hand like that. You know, I mean,
well, using a human carrier, that's certainly been written about in the scientific literature as well as in fiction and movie scenarios and so on.
Yeah, I think it's very troubling. Yeah, it's very troubling that somebody could do that. And as I'd suggested to Mike earlier, we'd discussed this earlier, Doctor, and I said to him he probably should call Valerie Jarrett at the White House, because if he said that undocumented aliens and the homeless were going to get infected with Ebola, they'd probably shut the flights down immediately, Doctor, as opposed to waiting. But that's just my opinion. I could be completely wrong.
I can't speculate on what people at the White House might do.
No, I know you can't, and I was being rather facetious there, and I shouldn't have been. I do apologize for that. So, Doctor, in closing, do you think we've dodged a bullet on this one potentially at the moment? Fortunately, it sounds like, touch wood, Mr. Duncan's relatives who were in the apartment with him, let's hope they're all clear. And let's hope that, you know, the two nurses haven't perpetuated the virus to anybody else. If this is the end of this, even though it caused chaos for about a week here, do you perceive we were very, very lucky?
I think that we were lucky this time, but Mr. Duncan probably won't be the last person who comes into the U.S. and is found to be infected after he gets here.
Yeah, I have a feeling you're right. And do you think there's a chance that this Ebola will be able to get under control in the three countries where it's particularly prevalent in West Africa? Or is it going to take a massive effort from all sorts of aid groups? And you're not really, by the sound of you, I don't want to put words in your mouth, you're not really seeing enough of an effort for this many people, because some sources are saying, you know, the numbers they're talking about are maybe only half of the numbers of people that are really infected, because a lot of people keep their relatives at home and are not in hospitals and things. Some people are saying that the numbers could be towards 20,000 people already affected.
Well, I think it could well be. And 1.4 million are predicted by January, and then they don't say what's going to happen after January. I mean, there are people who are pretty excited about the idea that Ebola could kill off 90% of the people on the planet. And for people who think that human beings are a vermin or a disaster for the planet, a threat to the health of the planet, some actually think that would be good.
Yeah, I think there's some of the Georgia Guidestone people that speak to us, and that is one of the theories. I do agree there are people like that. Anyway, we have one final corner. Rock from California, you're on with Dr. Orient, Rock.
Hello, Dr. Orient, how are you?
Okay.
My question to you is the Ebola virus the parvovirus that jumps species?
Well, it has jumped species. I mean, it's killed off a lot of gorillas and chimpanzees. It lives in fruit bats as one of its reservoir species. It can live in pigs and dogs, and without killing the animal, conceivably it could find a way to be transmitted dog to human instead of dog to dog. So, yeah, the worry about it's a zoonotic virus. It affects animals, and a lot of these viruses do spill over into the human population.
Okay, because I've cured parvovirus with just a simple cocktail of pumpkin, yogurt, and Pedialyte, where the doctor, the veterinarian, wanted to put the dogs on antibiotics for 24 hours with no guarantees. So
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, it wasn't a question. It was an answer. I said that I had cured the parvovirus on a dog without any medications, just by using yogurt, pumpkin, and Pedialyte, which is electrolytes, and I forced it down his throat and shot the liquid into his throat. 3 days later, the dog was fine.
Well, who knows what the effect of your medication was. A lot of people will die of Ebola or a lot of other things who might be able to fight off the virus themselves if someone can keep them alive with fluid long enough. I mean, a lot of them will die just of simple dehydration. So Pedialyte or equivalent oral rehydration solution can be life-saving in many of these people.
So really, your thoughts are, Doctor, is if we could help these people in Africa in any way, really, would like IVs be of enormous help to them, along with things like Pedialyte, Lucozade, various other electrolyte-type substances that could give their body a fighting chance and keep them hydrated to fight off the worst of the effects of the Ebola?
Oh, absolutely. That is the mainstay of treatment that we have available right now. And obviously, if you're losing 10 liters of fluid a day and vomiting and diarrhea and you don't have an IV, you're going to die.
Yeah, and I would think that sounds like the logical way to go then. If they could get people trained enough to be able to put some IVs in some people, it may save lots of lives. And on that, we thank you very much, Dr. Jane Orient. It was a pleasure having you on The People Speak. I think a lot of people are happy to hear people in the medical community who, like you, are very concerned about this and are looking to contain this virus where it is. So thank you very much for being with us on The People Speak tonight, Dr. Orient, and taking time out of your busy schedule.
Thank you.
Good. We will see you next week with The People Speak. And I believe, actually, Rock has a show tomorrow at his regular scheduled time, which is 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 Pacific. Thank you for listening. This is Rob Kitzel saying good night from The People Speak Radio Network. Thank you all.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.